We use a drink right now.
Chapter 17. Carson stepped off Valiant's cargo ramp onto the deck of Spirit's main shuttle bay and watched as the refurbished ore miner sat down on the other side of the expansive bay. Sergeant West appeared next to her, wearing his ratty utility overalls, wiping his hands with a dirty rag. They watched as the ship settled onto its landing struts, pressurized gases streaming from relief valves as they absorbed the weight of the miner.
"I have to say, Chief," West said, "there was a minute there when I didn't think we were going to make it back."
Carson nodded.
"You're not the only one."
"Chief Carson."
Carson and West turned, both snapping to attention as Director Hale approached.
"Sir."
Carson held his gaze, trying to guess the man's demeanor. Hale held out his hand and she shook it.
"Welcome back."
"Thank you, sir."
"Sergeant West,"
the two men shook hands.
"I hear you had a rough time out there."
"Not at all, sir. Just another day for a Pathfinder."
Two large cargo ramps unfolded from the sides of the ore miner, and passengers streamed out without waiting for the ramps to finish lowering. Several of Spirit's crew waited a few feet away with food, clothes, and other supplies. Two medical teams stood by, scanning the new arrivals.
"They look tired," Hale said.
4 days in the ship, it took them to slavery on Negev,"
Carson said.
"And this was the last batch of survivors. There was some healthy skepticism that the ore ship wouldn't come back. A little pessimism after years in captivity is expected. But that's all of them. Every last colonist from Negev."
Hale nodded at the ore miner.
"We'll get them shuttled down to the surface after medical clears them. Reintegrating the early arrivals has had a few hiccups. I still can't believe you were able to salvage that old freighter. It still doesn't look like it could make the trip once, much less several times."
"The colonists were..."
Carson paused, trying to think of the right words.
"Extremely motivated, sir."
"Indeed."
"I'm sorry about your brother, sir."
The corner of Hale's mouth twitched, and for a moment Carson thought she saw a flash of anger, but it vanished almost as quickly as it appeared, replaced with regret. He nodded.
"Thank you."
"I am curious about something, sir."
Hale raised an eyebrow.
"What did he mean when he said Clouseau would never have gotten caught? What's a Clouseau?"
Hale sniffed.
"Jared and I watched a lot of movies as kids. Our parents were gone a lot, and we had a lot of free time. One of our favorite movies was called The Spanish Prisoner, about a con man trying to scam money from some corporate executives. The movie ends with the con man being outsmarted by his victim, and he's taken to jail."
Carson frowned.
"So the actor who played the con man starred in another movie called The Pink Panther as a bumbling inspector named Clouseau. But no matter how bad Clouseau messed up, he always seemed to come out on top. Well, Jared always had a hard time separating the two characters and was convinced the Clouseau would have been able to anticipate the con man's downfall and come out on top. He just didn't understand that the actor was playing two different characters."
Hale shrugged. It turned into a reoccurring joke.
"So," Carson said, "he was trying to tell you something?"
Hale nodded thoughtfully. "I know my brother. And despite everything I read in your report, I don't believe that he would willingly turn against us. I have to believe there's something else going on that's forcing him to act the way he is. Making the reference to Clouseau might be his way of telling us that he's playing a long con. I just wish I knew what the endgame was."
"Be that as it may, we have to treat him as hostile if we ever encounter him or the Altari again."
Carson straightened.
I agree with your assessment, sir."
"You did good work out there, Chief,"
Hale said after several long moments.
"Get you and your team to New Jefferson before sunset. There's a party."
He looked down at the screen on his gauntlet and walked off, grumbling.
"Did someone say party?"
Nunez asked, coming down the Valiant's ramp. Birch, Popoff, and Moretti followed him down. They all looked as tired as Carson felt. Weeks of fighting and labor had taken their toll, even on the Pathfinders.
"I do believe he said party,"
Birch said.
"Well, it's inconvenient," Popoff said, looking down at her stained overalls. "You have nothing to wear." "I'm sure you'll find something, Jerry," Nunez said. "This is probably one party you don't want to miss."
Popov glared at him. Don't call me Cherry. Nunez held up his hands as if he was surrendering.
Hey, don't get worked up. It's all in fun.
The fun comes later, West said, after our gear is inventoried, stowed, and replacement parts ordered from the foundry. Just because we're home doesn't mean we quit on the objective.
Nunez groaned, his shoulders drooping.
Turn and burn, team, Carson said. We could all use a breather.
Chapter 18. Pain and agony were the only thing Jared Hale knew when he opened his eyes. He felt vibrations to the floor underneath him, and as his vision focused, he could see a line of empty pods around them. He reached down and touched his chest. His flesh was tender to the touch, and the muscles underneath sore. He sat up and coughed. Flecks of dry blood spat from his mouth into the deck. Gritting his teeth, he pushed himself into a sitting position, grunting against the pain. He felt the wires running up and down his spine moving, like worms just beneath his skin.
There we are.
The Duke put a finger beneath his chin and lifted him up. Jared's armor moved of its own volition to obey the Duke's command.
Can't lose such a tool. Who else will lead your dog soldiers?
Just kill me, Jared said.
The Duke shook his head slowly, the lights of his eyes never wavering.
We had a bargain. Don't you remember? Your service for the survival of your people. The Emperor can be a bit rash. To condemn all those on the Negev to die was not in keeping with our agreement, and I argued that you were right to stop that act, hence you were not permitted to die. Are we not kind?
The Duke took his hand away from Jared's face and walked to a pod in a wall. The shell melted away, revealing three small sacks filled with neon green fluid and a dark lump within.
We will be glorious, the Duke said, but it will take time. To feel again, to taste food, smell air. Yes, we can wait a bit more.
It pointed to the end of the chamber where a bank of four Doughboy constructor units sat unpowered.
You will begin work on the next generation of Neverguard, the Duke said. We allowed some leeway with their appearance, as their function was more important than the form. Now you will craft them exactly as we specify. Understood?
Master.
Jared felt his heart ache. He'd thought his last act of defiance would be the end of him, the last of his pain with a triumvirate.
Master, may I see them?
Ah, you need motivation. The Duke's head tilted from side to side. A human's oath is not enough. You require more than our method of coercion. So noted. Perhaps you think we left with such enthusiasm you hoped we might make a mistake. If it's the former, I'm disappointed in you. If it's the latter, I'm insulted.
The Duke twirled a fingertip around and Jared's armor spun in place. A pod floated off the wall and the front faded away. Jared's breath caught in his throat and his knees buckled. His armor kept him standing. His stomach twisted and he couldn't stop the tears from coming. His wife Sarah hung in stasis, head down slightly, her beautiful brown hair hanging over her face. The simple dress she wore accentuated her pregnant belly. One slender arm wrapped around their four-year-old daughter Mary, clutching her leg. Both appeared peaceful, as if they were sleeping.
Do you understand your usefulness to us? The Duke asked.
Oh, Sarah.
Jared's voice was barely a whisper as he struggled to fight back the rising tide of emotion.
Please, don't hurt them anymore. Please?
Who do you serve?
The Duke asked.
You. The true Emperor of the Altari. I serve the Triumvirate. Always.
The pod sank back into the floor. Jared tried to reach for his family, but his armor held him still.
Once we have our empire, the Duke said, once the blasphemous construct is destroyed, you will be made whole again. Our bargain remains.
What must I do?
Jared's gaze fell to the floor.
Create your perfect soldiers. Obey. We will arrive at a remnant world soon, and then the fallen empire will rise again.
Chapter 19.
Carson leaned against a railing and looked down at the party in the middle of New Jefferson's administration building. Tables with wide bowls of punch and piles of food were being picked over by a crowd of happy people. She took a sip of beer in an unlabeled bottle and felt a slight buzz, even though she still had a quarter left. There was a strict one-drink limit at this soiree, a precaution she could understand, as the survivors from Negev had lost their tolerance long ago, and with the colony still on high alert, anyone that got drunk would be useless in an emergency. She could make out the original colonists easily enough. They still hadn't recovered all their lost weight, and they moved timidly as if the Nether Guards still watched over them.
"We're not going back to normal any time soon," she thought.
She looked out a window to distant floodlights. She'd done a quick survey of the security perimeter around the city and shared a number of pressing concerns with Captain Handley. She felt the urge to inspect the southern towers again, but Marie Hale had strongly encouraged her to show up to the celebration. Carson took a sip of her beer and scanned the crowd. She found Tony and Steven sitting at a table near the corner of the room, smiling and talking with their parents. The two boys from the mountain outpost had found their parents just before the party officially kicked off, and it looked like they'd finally stopped crying. Tony still hadn't let go of his mother. He sat on her lap, his arms wrapped around her, head nestled against her chest. A burst of raucous laughter drew her attention to the bar, where she found Popoff and Nunez. Nunez had a small flask in hand that he slipped into his jacket. Popoff took a slow sip from a clear plastic cup filled with soda, and a little kicker, Carson suspected.
"West smells that on them, and they wish they'd never heard of alcohol," she thought.
Birch and Danielle talked to each other at a table along the outer wall, the gremlin between them, and opened up. The two had spent an inordinate amount of time together repairing the ore miner and discussing technobabble that made Carson's eyes glaze over. Moretti had opted to do another shift at the hospital. He'd seemed more interested in healing the sick and injured than spending time with the healthy. Wes decided to forego the party to spend some quiet time with his family in their new apartment, a decision Carson didn't fault. She'd managed 5 words with Wes's wife before the sergeant had slipped away with his family. Families. Carson felt a twinge of guilt. Wes had been injured on Negev, tortured, nearly killed. If Carson hadn't rescued him, she would have had to look his widow in the eye and say she'd failed. She'd done that before, and never wanted to do it again. She went to take another sip of beer, but was interrupted by a chime from her forearm computer. A message on the screen requesting her presence in the new headquarters area set up near the spaceport.
"What now?"
Carson asked aloud, then tossed back the beer, finishing it and settling the empty bottle on the balcony's floor. She took another look at the partiers below, then turned and headed for the exit. A text message on a small screen on her wrist read RTB ASAP. Return to base as soon as possible. Carson shivered as she stepped out into the chill night air. A fog had settled across the city during the evening, and lights from the surrounding buildings barely managed to cut through the gloom. She jogged through the city, passing small groups of colonists, nodding and returning greetings as she went. If there had been a full-scale alert, sirens would be blazing across the city. The summons could have been anything else, and if she tore back to the command post, it could spark a panic. Rumors were almost as dangerous as a feral doughboy to the city's order and discipline. She reached the temporary headquarters building, nodded to the 2 sentries, and slipped inside. Computer stations lined the walls, and a large hollow table took up much of the center of the room. Hale and his staff stood around this table, studying a star map projected above it. Carson stopped at the edge of the hollow table and studied the starfield, waiting for Hale to finish his conversation. She recognized it as a map of the Terra Nova system, complete with a human fleet in orbit. Her eyes tracked across the map to a red orb labeled Negev, where a large cluster of red dots orbited the planet.
"Chief Carson," Hale said, looking at her through the holo. "Thank you for coming so quickly."
"Of course, sir.
We just picked up a massive energy signal from Negev," Hale said. "One of the sensor platforms you left behind is relaying some data."
"Sir?"
"It appears that a fleet of 100 ships have arrived in the orbit of Negev. The sensors picked up an energy reading in line with what the Valiant collected when the Triumvirate ship vanished."
"How many?"
Carson asked.
"Where did they come from?"
Commander Edison shook his head. "From what we've been able to gather, they simply appeared in orbit." Carson thought about that for a moment, then said,
Lieutenant Lincoln said he watched the Triumvirate ship go to warp and disappear. The Altari are already back.
It's possible, Edison said.
Very probably.
Marie Hale corrected. Hugh shook her head.
Faster than light travel without crucibles? Incredible.
How big are these ships?
She did some quick math, and if the new arrivals were the same size as the Triumvirate's escape ship and filled with Netherguard troops, Terra Nova didn't stand a chance. One of the techs on the side of the room looked up from his station.
Director Hale, sir, we're receiving a transmission.
Put it through, Hale said. The starfield vanished, replaced by a swirling fractal pattern of multicolored lights.
What are you?
A voice asked. The swirling fractals pulsed and shifted colors with each word.
My name is Ken Hale, director of Human Colony Terra Nova. To whom am I speaking?
What have you done with the exiles?
Hale frowned.
I'm afraid I don't know what you mean.
Poison in the water, the shadow around the light, the supreme failure, the exiled ones who have been silent this past age of peace and prosperity. Where are they?
You mean the Triumvirate?
Hale asked.
Your guess is as good as mine.
You set them free.
It was a statement, not a question.
No, we...
By the sacred intelligence, speak the truth and we shall be merciful. What have you done with the exiled ones?
Hale looked over the faces of his staff, as if looking for an answer. Finally, he said,
I know you're probably not going to believe me when I say this, but I don't know. They disappeared from Negev's orbit many days ago in a ship that appeared to travel faster than the speed of light. We don't know where they went.
The fractals pulsed red.
Do you know what you've done? What they are capable of?
Hale squeezed the rail around the holotank.
We are aware of what this triumvirate is capable of. They enslaved our people, and we've only recently broken free from their control. If you're going to hunt them down, we're interested in helping you.
What is your species? You're not Zeiss. How have you escaped the sacred intelligence's knowledge?
The fractals went still, and everyone around the table exchanged confused glances. The fractals disappeared, replaced by the starfield.
Transmission terminated, the staffer announced.
We're picking up additional energy spikes near the Negev system,
Hugh said. Carson watched as clusters of additional red dots appeared on the holomap above Negev.
Another fleet? Hale asked.
Commander Edison moved to one of the stations along the side of the room. He peered over the shoulder of its operator.
It's difficult to say if they're exact, but the signatures are similar to the ships already in orbit.
God, I wish we'd brought the Breitenfeld with us,
Murray said. Heads nodded around the table, accompanied by murmurs of agreement.
We're receiving another transmission, Director.
Oh, good.
Hale squeezed his temples.
Put it through.
The holomap vanished again, this time replaced by an alien that resembled the Netherguard, but its skull was smoother, less bestial. A crown of ridged bone stretched from the top of its eye sockets back over its skull. Gold rings hung from bone outcroppings along its forehead and above where human ears would be. Its eyes, sunk back into deep sockets, glowed, one green and one orange.
By order of the true Altari Empire,
the alien said,
you will tell us why we detected a warp signature from this world.
The Altari's head pulled back slightly.
What are you?
Light around the alien's face went red, and guttural shouts spilled over the open channel. The image blinked out, again replaced by the holomap.
Just a guess, Marie said, but we seem to have a mess on our hands.
Pull all the data you can, Hale said. Give us some sort of technical readout on their ships. Their communications are coming to us from Negev in almost real time. There should be a 3-minute delay, so they've got faster-than-light communications as well.
2 minutes later, the plot on the first group of alien ships lurched toward the new arrivals.
We are watching the battle on lag,
Marie said.
They could be here before we see them leave,
Hale said.
Sir,
Commander Edison said.
The fleets are moving. It looks like they're converging on each other.
More energy spikes, Colonel. I think they're firing on each other,
Hugh said.
Hale turned to Marie. What's the status on our bunkers?
His wife shook her head.
A handful are up and running. The rest won't be finished for another couple of days, a week on the outside.
Hale pursed his lips, breathing deeply through his nose.
I want every militia leader here in 10 minutes. Have the medical staff start handing out stems and start getting people sobered up. Terra Nova's the only home we've got, and we're not going to give it up without a fight.
He turned his attention to Carson.
Is your team ready to jump back into the fray?
Pathfinders light the darkness, sir.
He nodded. Good. Get your team together and report back here.
Carson snapped off a salute, then turned and set out to bring her team the bad news. Sergeant Ricks shivered as a cold breeze blew through his guard shack. A weather front had moved in after almost a week of heavy rain, turning their once temperate climb into something chilly and miserable. Ricks wasn't sure if it was the season changing or just an infantryman's luck that he'd be out in this weather. He lifted a mug to his lips, then cursed. Empty again. He turned away from the railing to the small table in the corner of their small shack and poured his sixth cup of coffee. The engineers hadn't gotten around to elevating their post, and Ricks was okay with that. He didn't much like heights and was entirely content to keep his feet on solid ground for as long as he could. He checked the sensor screens again and logged yet another hour of NSTR. Nothing significant to report.
Shit, man! Don't you ever want to sleep?
Eaton said from his seat at the other side of the shack. He sat, legs stretched out in front of him, arms folded across his chest, his Gauss rifle propped against the wall behind him. Rick stirred 2 helpings of creamer into the steaming liquid.
Like we're gonna be getting any sleep with what's going on.
We're supposed to be on light duty after getting worked over by those doughies. Take it light. Still, I'd just like to know exactly what is going on. Command's got their panties in a bunch about something.
Well, that information, Private, is need to know,
Rick said with a grin.
And we don't need to know, as we've not been told.
Eaton sniffed.
Yeah, I've heard that plenty of times before. Usually right after everything goes down the crapper, and I wish I'd had a few minutes of warning.
You should be used to it, then.
You ever wonder why they sold a load of crap on Terra Nova? My recruiter was from Iceland or something, a Viking. Never trust a Scandinavian when it comes to real estate. Greenland, my ass. Don't trust a military recruiter either, ever. Doesn't matter where they're from.
Hey, they put Hale in charge, Rick said. That was a big plus for me.
Anyone else was in charge and I'd be too scared to sleep.
Rick chuckled, then took a careful sip of his coffee. He peered out into the darkness, squinting to try and see through the thick fog. Floodlights affixed to the top of their shack did little to illuminate their sector of responsibility. In fact, the powerful lights reflecting off the low-lying clouds probably made it worse, like driving with your high beams in a snowstorm.
I don't know how they expect us to see anything in this soup, Rick said. Would have been better to set up motion sensors and give us infrared scanners, but no, deal with what you have, they said.
I hear they're in the production queue.
Yeah, just like those Gauss rifles were promised before they shuttle us down here.
They had manufacturing issues,
Eaton said, sitting up.
At least they took the time to give us pea-shooter carbines instead of giving us faulty rifles.
Ricks opened his mouth to respond when something moved in his peripheral, a shadow in the fog. He turned, focusing on where he thought the shadow had been, but saw nothing.
Did you see that?
Eaton chuckled.
I thought you said he couldn't see anything.
The shadow moved again, and Rick set his cup aside and picked up his rifle.
I think there's something out there. Call it in.
Rick opened the door slowly.
Who goes there?
No one answered. Eaton stood and leaned out over the rail next to Rick's. After a few seconds of looking, he said,
I don't see anything.
I'm sure something moved out there.
Maybe it was an animal or something.
Rick shook his head without taking his eyes from the spot.
I don't know, man. I haven't seen any animals bigger than a cat around here the last couple of days. Have you?
Well, no, but that doesn't...
Doesn't what?
Ricks asked. When Eaton didn't answer, Ricks turned.
Eaton, what?
The rest of his words stuck in his throat as he turned to see Eaton standing there with a knife to his throat. A woman stood behind the private, face covered in sweat and dirt, her eyes locked on Ricks.
Shut up. And don't do anything stupid. She said.
Mind racing, Ricks tried to calculate how quickly he could bring his rifle to bear.
He dismissed the idea almost immediately. The woman wouldn't need a quarter of the time he'd need to slit his partner's throat, and then she'd be on him.
"Whoa, whoa, there, lady," Rick said. "You don't look like those doughboys. You know, we're all friends here, human, just like you. No need to get violent."
An arm wrapped around his neck, and he felt the press of a knife against his back. The smell of unwashed clothes and body odor almost made Rick's gag.
"Maybe we want some violence,"
an old man whispered into Rick's ear. The woman appeared to be in her early 50s. Her salt and pepper hair was cut short and matted to her head.
"Nice!"
Rick squeaked.
"We can be nice, too!"
"Here's what's gonna happen," she said. "I'm gonna ask you and your friend here some questions, and you're gonna answer them truthfully and quickly, or this interrogation will get not nice so fast you'll wonder if you ever had all 10 fingertips.
I don't have time to bullshit you and drag this whole thing out longer than it needs to be, so I'll be quick and to the point.
You give me straight answers, I won't kill you. Understood?"
Rick nodded. Eaton managed to just barely nod, his eyes wide in panic.
"Please,"
Eaton said, his voice a whimper.
"Don't kill me."
"Like I said, if you're straight with me, you won't have anything to worry about."
"When did you all arrive here? I don't recognize you." Rick squirmed against the knife point over his kidneys.
"The Enduring Spirit made the jump weeks ago. Second wave of colonists from Earth."
"Told you Ibarra could do it,"
the man holding Rick said.
"Did you come here to fight the Altari?"
"I..."
Rick paused, shaking his head.
"I don't understand."
"The Nether Guards. Big ugly doughboys. We heard the shooting. What happened to those monsters?"
"We killed them all," Rick said. "Shot them. Dumped the bodies in the incinerator. That okay with you?"
"Who's in charge?"
"Hale,"
Eaton said, his voice cracking. The woman's face went pale, and she pressed the knife to Eaton's neck.
"What did you say?"
she asked. Eaton shook his head back and forth, eyes clamped shut, lips pressed together, obviously not wanting to answer.
"You heard him,"
the man said.
"Let's make it quick and get out of here."
"No!"
The grip on Rick's throat choked him as he tried to yell.
"Hale, Ken Hale, retired colonel, founder of the Pathfinder Corps, treaty, the guy in that damn corny movie, that Ken Hale!"
The woman held Rick's gaze for a long moment as if she was trying to determine whether he was telling the truth or not. Finally, she said,
"Huh."
She took the knife away from Eaton's neck and pushed him away. As soon as the knife was clear, Eaton lurched away from the woman, grabbing his rifle and bringing it up, leveling it at her. This time, it was the woman's turn to lift her arms in the air.
"Easy. Had to make sure you're all on the right side."
The point against Rick's back went away, and the arm around his throat slackened. He spun around and found an old man wearing rags and a drooping beard halfway down his chest. The man took a rough wooden crutch off the wall and tucked it beneath a shoulder. He spun a combat knife in his hand and slipped it into a sheath.
"I knew that Hale on the Breitenfeld,"
he said to the woman.
"Brave enough. Ibarra took a liking to him."
"Wait, you were on the Breitenfeld? When?"
Rick shook his head quickly and pointed at the old man's weapon.
"How about you drop that knife, too?"
"Come and get it, kid,"
the old man huffed.
"Mr. Knight's had that a hell of a lot longer than you've been alive, soldier,"
the woman said.
"Let's all calm down. Turns out we really are friends here."
She went to the coffee table and took a long sip straight from the carafe.
"You're part of the First Colony mission, are you?"
Rick asked.
"Got it in one."
"What do you want?"
Eaton blurted out. The woman smiled.
"I want quite a bit. But first things first, I need to talk to Director Hale." "And what makes you think he'll want to talk to you?"
"I have some information I'm sure he'll want."
"You're gonna have to do better than that,"
Rick said. The woman gave him a half smile.
"You tell Hale that Shannon Martell is here, and that I have information about his brother, Jared."
Book 2. Bloodlines. Chapter 1. Missiles shot through the void, weaving through red-hot particle beams and spinning wreckage of dead warships. The point defense turrets on a white-hulled alien frigate fired methodically, destroying incoming threats with measured precision. Three missiles closed on the ship and their engines flared, launching them forward like tips of a hurled trident. The target ship seemed to realize its fate and shifted its fire to missiles targeting other vessels. Warheads exploded against the hull, sending blackened debris hurtling away. The missiles gutted the ship, leaving the keel and some of the superstructure intact. The frigate rolled over and succumbed to the gravity of the dusty red planet of Negev. The dead ship became a burning comet within minutes, joining dozens of other ships, leaving smoky lines across the atmosphere. Another salvo of missiles rippled out of the deep green Ultari ships and bore down on their foes that arrived in the Terra Nova system with glistening white hulls. The warring ships had some design elements in common. A wide center line dotted with cannons and shuttle bays, ventral and dorsal hulls that tapered to flat ridges running the length of the ships, superstructures for the command section, though the Ultari ships had irregular clumps of antennae around their bridges. The belligerents seemed to spring from a shared history, though what had caused the schism and subsequent hatred wasn't written into their hulls. Particle cannons on the white ships massed fire on an Ultari ship and hammered it into slag in less than a minute. The Ultari missiles swarmed the opposing ships, scoring hits infrequently. Two destroyer analogs from the White Fleet exploded simultaneously, and the ship at the center of the fleet, it barely half again the size of the destroyers, maneuvered away from the fight and flew toward Negev's northern pole. White ships pulled closer to the flagship, targeting any missile that homed in on the larger ship. From the Ultari fleet's larger missiles launched and closed rapidly. And then the battle froze.
There.
Governor Hale reached into the holotank and touched the larger missiles.
You see those? Give me a full plot trace on those and enhance.
The holographic image flickered and zoomed away from the battle above Negev and stretched through the tank. Pulsing red dots appeared over the large missiles as they shrank from view. The Ultari ships became red diamonds, the white vessels green squares. With his god's eye view, Chief Carson noticed the Ultari were in a loose formation, almost a mob of ships. Their enemies held a close-knit formation as they attempted to escape the fight. The governor reached into the tank and touched the torpedo icons. A solid but wavy line traced from the Ultari ships to their targets. Hale traced along the path, watching the telemetry box that popped up next to his fingertips change.
Exo,
Marie Hale said with a slight shake of her head.
Scrub the data for a solid image. My husband was a marine, never a ship driver. This isn't his fort.
Aye, aye,
Edison said from a workstation near the holotank. The tank rematerialized into a slightly pixelated image of one of the larger missiles. Measurements and more data overlays appeared. The four 30-meter-long cylindrical tubes hung in space, seconds away from impacting the white flagship. The front ends were sharp cones of what looked like some kind of reinforced steel. Just behind the base of the cone, five large claws had folded out from recesses along the hull.
Boarding pods, Carson thought.
As if he'd read her mind, Hale said,
Ship-to-ship assault. Risky.
The assembled officers and colony directors nodded but remained silent. During the first few playbacks, several had made the mistake of trying to narrate the battle, which had earned them a quick rebuke from the governor. Hale crossed his arms, staring at the image in quiet contemplation. After several moments, he sighed.
Okay, bookmark this timestamp. We'll come back to it later. Let's finish this last run-through.
The image zoomed back to the view of the entire battle and resumed. The battle degraded into a rout as the Ultari overwhelmed their enemies and ran them down one at a time. The Ultari vessels vanished in a flash of warp drive moments after the last enemy ship exploded into a rain of fragments that plummeted to Negev. Murmurs went up around the table as the alien ship disappeared. That the aliens had arrived in ships equipped with faster-than-light engines had been a shock to Terra Nova. Such technology only existed, in theory, back in the Milky Way. Carson watched in silence as data from the battle continued to trickle into the holotank. She touched the screen built into the forearm of her Pathfinder armor and queried the computers for a body count from the battle. A graph appeared, showing 100% losses for the White Fleet,
almost 64 ships by the best estimate and roughly 80 vessels destroyed on the Altari side. The Altari had arrived with more hulls and seemingly better firepower, but the white ships fought with more cohesion and managed to inflict disproportionate losses. A dozen Altari ships left the system. The playback ended and Carson breathed a sigh of relief when Hale didn't ask for yet another replay. Catching the boarding craft had been a new development, but she wasn't sure what more could be learned from the recording. Neither side had shown the slightest interest in the human colony on Terra Nova once they realized they shared space over Negev. The lights inside the headquarters building brightened slightly as the hologram faded. From across the table, Carson could tell the governor wasn't pleased. Hale's face was frozen in a mixture of deep contemplation and frustration. Not that she could blame him. Arriving on Terra Nova to discover the first colonists were missing, the only city overrun with homicidal brutes, and rescuing the first wave of settlers from alien despots had not been the plan for the Enduring Spirit or her crew. The governor bore the mantle of leadership and the knowledge that his brother had turned traitor and escaped with the Triumvirate. Carson didn't envy Hale, but she knew he was up to the challenge. The man had fought through worse.
All right, Hale said finally. What are we looking at?
All at once, the gathered leaders of Terra Nova began speaking. Hale put both hands up.
Wait, wait, enough. Okay, we'll go around the table. Commander Edison?
Russell Edison, Enduring Spirit's executive officer, the flagship of the second Terra Nova fleet, rubbed his chin. He shook his head and said,
Obviously, both sides are advanced races. I'm definitely gonna have to get a look at a more detailed report of their weapon systems, but on the face of it, they're much more advanced than we are. Maybe another 50 years or so on beam weapon technology, but everything else about it seemed fairly standard.
Except for the faster-than-light travel, Elizabeth Tanner said. The colony's chief engineer stood a few people to Carson's left, arms crossed, head canted to one side.
Did you forget about that, Commander?
Edison worked his jaw, glaring at the woman.
No, Ms. Tanner, I hadn't forgotten about that.
Of course you didn't, she said, giving him a half-smile. I mean, I know ship drive technology is at the very bottom of the list for you Navy types. They're not as loud and shiny as those new weapon systems I saw you eyeing, but they are extremely important.
Edison opened his mouth to answer, but Captain George Handley, the ground forces commander of the new colonial militia, beat him to it.
I'm actually more concerned that the Altari commander mentioned he was part of the true Altari Empire. I thought the Triumvirate were Altari. And why did they look so different? They were organic, not cybernetic like the Emperor and the other two.
Carson shuddered as the images of the mechanical monstrosities flashed in her mind. The skeletal aliens were creatures straight out of a nightmare. Their skull-like faces and thin metallic chassis made them visually intimidating to say the least, not to mention their speed and impressive strength.
That's a very good question, Captain, Hale said. Ms. Danielle, any insights into that?
Danielle Scartucci, one of the original colonists Carson's Pathfinder team had rescued from the Triumvirate, looked up at Hale's words, seeming to shake herself from thought.
What? I'm...
Two images flashed into existence over the holotable. One, the robotic head of the Triumvirate leader, Emperor Kyrios. The other, the Altari fleet commander. The Emperor's sleek, metallic head was featureless, save for the crown of razors surrounding the top of its skull. Its eyes glowed bright yellow, its mouth nothing more than a line set at the bottom of its face. The fleet commander's skull looked similar to the Nether Guard soldiers, only smoother, less bestial. A ridge of bone extended from above its eyes back over the top of its skull, edges adorned with gold rings. Its eyes were sunk back into deep sockets, one glowing green and the other orange. Danielle stepped back from the table, wide eyes locked onto the image of the Emperor. After a moment, she looked away, obviously shaken.
I'm sorry.
Marie Hale stepped up next to the woman, putting a hand on her shoulder.
It's okay. Take your time.
Danielle sniffed, pursing her lips, and lifted her eyes to the holographic image.
I'm okay.
She seemed to shake off her earlier shock, taking on an air of pure determination. The Triumvirate are the old leaders of the Altari. We could never figure out exactly what happened, but most of us believe the others, the ones in the white ships that mentioned a supreme intelligence, defeated and imprisoned them, but that's only a theory.
And their robotic bodies? Hale asked.
Danielle shook her head.
They never gave us the truth. Jared Hale may have known, as he worked with him constantly, but he never told it to us while we were there as slaves. The first sob story the Triumvirate fed us was that they were survivors from some long-dead civilization. Then it became clear they were the true rulers of that civilization. It wasn't until after we were moved to the mountain with the faces that we realized Negev was their prison. That the Supreme Intelligence Fleet was so upset with us for mucking about with the Triumvirate reinforces that those monsters were imprisoned here.
Why didn't the Altari come looking here sooner?
Marie asked.
Terra Nova is habitable. A prison without guards or walls?
The Altari must not have known, Hale said. This dwarf galaxy is still massive, even if it's not the Milky Way. Imagine tossing a diamond in the ocean 1,000 years ago and expecting someone to find it. Thank you, Miss Scartucci. Hale turned to Handley. What's the status on the security of the colony?
My ground forces have secured the area immediately surrounding the city and have set up round-the-clock guard posts and patrols. We've cleared out any and all Nether Guard from the city, though a few have been seen on the outskirts. 19 were destroyed in the last 24 hours, no casualties on our side. They don't seem to be active during the night. I'm reading sweep and clear teams for morning. As far as protection against space attack?
He shrugged. I understand, Hale said. Everyone present knew the answer to that question. If an enemy force attacked Terra Nova from orbit, the colony would have little chance of surviving. The only military ship they had was the Valiant, and even that was a little more than a fast transport with a single railgun mounted to the hull, a pea shooter in comparison to the weapons they'd observed during the battle over Negev.
Our first priority is to get Spirit's Foundry spinning on components for some kind of space defense force, Hale said. I know whatever we manage to put together in the short term won't be able to stand up to those Altari or these Supreme Intelligence ships, but something is better than nothing. Commander Edison drew up a plan to have the Spirit refit for void combat. We also need to dedicate one or two printers for colony ground defense.
Of course, sir, Edison said. I'd like to get my hands on those alien ships,
Marie said.
We could still salvage something useful from the wreckage. It'll give us a good idea of what we're truly dealing with.
There could be survivors, Carson spoke up. The satellites we left over Negev caught the big ships, weapons with massive energy signatures. The two fleets went at each other without mercy. They strike me as the type that would use a life pod for target practice.
It'll be some time before the Valiant can reach Negev, Hale said, nodding. Chance of survivors is slim.
Search and rescue is one of our...
I know damn well what the Pathfinder's mission is, Chief, Hale snapped. He rubbed a thumb against his temple and pointed a knife hand at her.
Prep your team. Get wheels up and Voidborn soon as possible.
Carson stepped up to the table.
Yes, sir.
Take Ms. Danielle and an engineering team with you, Hale said. Your primary mission is reconnaissance. I need information, not heroes.
Roger that, sir.
An aide stepped up from behind Captain Handley and whispered something into Hale's ear. He frowned as the man finished and straightened.
Marie, the governor said, you have the operations center. Seems there's a situation at one of the guard posts that needs my attention.
What is it?
Marie asked.
A ghost. A ghost named Shannon Martell.
Chapter 2. It was slightly cooler in Valiant's cargo bay than usual, but Carson found it oddly comforting. She rubbed her temple, shutting her eyes against the twinge of a headache building behind them. The stims were starting to work. Even after a short nap, the effects of the alcohol she'd consumed at the welcome home party were still lingering.
I didn't even have that much, she told herself, counting off how many drinks she'd downed before Hale had summoned her to the command post.
She'd never considered herself a lightweight before. But if she felt like this after just 3 drinks, Carson decided that might very well be the case now. The Valiant had broken Terra Nova orbit a few hours ago, and the ship had another day before it reached Negev. Spending transit time sitting on their hands was not the Pathfinder way. She and her team would prep constantly for the mission, and the first step was to take care of their equipment so the equipment would take care of them in the void and in combat. But doing the inspections coming off of an alcohol buzz was not ideal. She remembered this sort of thing being a lot easier when she was in her early 20s.
She took a deep breath and considered the sealed void suit sitting on the deck in front of her. Finding the Pathfinder's gear stored away in the bowels of the Enduring Spirit hadn't been a problem. It was clearing all the debris from the battle with the Netherguard and ensuring hull integrity before any of it could be retrieved. Now the majority of the team's gear was scattered across the Valiant's cargo deck, waiting to be inventoried and sorted by her team, that appeared to be in the same boat as Carson. Senior Voidman Vishnaya Popov, the junior member of Carson's team, dropped another supply container down at the end of a short row of similar containers, the sides painted with blue and white stripes.
"Eight,"
she said, breathing heavily. Staff Sergeant Jose Nunez, who'd been sitting on his blue and white striped void suit container, his head in his hands, looked up at the commotion, glaring at Popov.
"Are you serious, Cherry?"
The rookie Pathfinder straightened, hands on her hips.
"Don't call me that. And if you'd have gotten off your lazy ass and helped me, I would have been done already."
Nunez grimaced.
"Good luck with that. I can't even stand straight right now. Keep it down, will you?"
He put his face back into his hands. Across from him, Staff Sergeant Luca Moretti held up a small silver package.
"Here."
Nunez waved him off.
"All right, he took some. Not that they helped.
I've got a killer headache."
"That's just the stims working,"
Moretti told him, putting the pills back into his kit.
"You'll feel great in another 30 minutes or so."
Without lifting his face from his hands, Nunez said,
"Freaking wonders of modern medicine. We'll make you better, but kill you in the process."
If Nunez was in that bad of a shape, Carson wondered how much he'd had to drink. The leader in her made a note to take it up with West after this mission. As if on cue, Master Sergeant Jason West, her team's senior non-commissioned officer, moved around the large six-wheeled rover in the center of the bay. Immediately, Popov peeled off to busy herself with something as West angled toward Nunez.
"Are you dying?"
West said, stopping a few feet from Nunez, crossing his arms.
"I think it might be, Sarge."
"Sounds serious."
Carson couldn't help the grin forming at the side of her mouth as she saw where the sergeant was going.
"In that case, I guess we ought to send you to Sitka, get you checked out by the colony. The dock? Oh, wait. We're not on Terra Nova anymore. Moretti? Still have those needle injectors?"
Nunez jumped to his feet.
"Would you look at that? It's a miracle I'm healed."
"Ah, spectacular. Glad to hear it. The Lord works in mysterious ways. Now, since you're in much better shape, perhaps you could assist Popov here with unpacking these void suits and seal testing them."
Nunez's expression turned from one of surprised relief to utter disappointment.
"Yeah, but, Sarge, I..."
"You want to do them all yourself?"
Nunez seemed to recognize the writing on the wall and cut his losses.
"I'd be happy to help, Jerry, boss."
"Don't call me that!"
Popov shouted, looking up from the crate she was unpacking. Carson turned her attention back to her own void suit, breaking apart the factory seal and pulling back the plastic wrapping. She took a long breath, taking in the new suit's smell. It'd been years since she'd worn a fresh void suit, not since.
"You okay, Chief?"
West bent down next to Carson's suit, concern spread across his face. Carson nodded.
"I'm fine." She touched her temple. "I guess I had a little too much to drink, too."
"We all did,"
West said.
"But then again, we all deserved it. Work hard, play hard, right?"
"If you say so."
"Didn't figure we'd be back in here so soon,"
West said, looking around the Valiant's Bay.
"We're not setting a very promising trend, are we?"
West chuckled.
"Not at all."
"Was your wife upset?"
"Oh, she'll be all right."
Carson raised an eyebrow at him.
"No,"
West said, smiling and shaking his head.
"She knows the deal. We've been together longer than I've been a military man. She's used to it. It's the kids that don't appreciate it too much."
"Sorry we had to take you away again so soon."
"Yeah, they'll get used to it too. I did."
"Oh?"
"Dad joined the Strike Marines before the Ember War. He was always gone. It just becomes one of those things, I guess."
"Well, hopefully it doesn't become a thing here."
"Indeed. You need help with that?
Wes nodded to her void suit.
I think I can handle it. Been a while.
As long as you're not taking any wild jumps into open cargo base, I think this trip will be relatively quiet.
Carson grimaced and wrapped a fist on the deck.
You gonna jinx us? Never say a mission's gonna be quiet.
Wes grinned and waved a hand through the air.
Never believe that old wives' tale. If it's gonna get crazy, it's gonna get crazy, no matter what I say.
You know, there's a reason why traditions become traditions, right?
Standing, West said,
Oh, yeah. I've created a number of them myself. Speaking of which.
He turned back toward the team and yelled,
Pressure loss! Emergency actions!
Amongst a chorus of curses and groans, the four other members of Carson's Pathfinder team struggled to find their protective masks and get them in place. Nunez knocked over a supply crate in his rush for his kit, forcing Moretti to jump away, cursing. Popoff struggled to get her bag open, cursing as she turned it over in her hand. Alan Birch, the team's drone wrangler, sat back against the rover and crossed his arms, his mask already in place. After everyone else had their masks in place, and hand lifted in the air, indicating they had a good seal, West checked his watch.
Horrible! Terrible time! I've seen Navy pukes do better by a wide margin. Looks like we have some training to do. Let's get these suits unpacked and checked out. Then we're gonna spend some quality time in remedial.
The guards saluted as Hale approached.
I wish they'd stop doing that,
Hale thought, returning the salute.
I'm gonna meet with the prisoner.
Of course, sir,
the guard said, unlocking the door, then pushing it open. The woman, Shannon Martell, looked up from her steaming mug as Hale entered the room and smiled. She lifted the mug slightly and said,
I'll give you Strike Marines one thing. You sure do know how to make a cup of coffee. You learned this from the Navy?
Hale nodded to the guard.
Thank you, soldier. You can wait outside.
The guard frowned, but nodded.
Yes, sir.
As the door shut behind him, Hale turned back to the new arrivals. Shannon sat nursing a cup of coffee, a plate of crumbs sitting on the table in front of her. Her graying hair was pulled back in a loose ponytail, strands of which framed her slightly Asian features. The other man lounged back in a hard plastic chair, his leg propped up on another chair in front of him.
And the food's not half bad either.
Eric Knight sat around a mouthful of food. Hale crossed his arms.
I'm glad you approve. It's been a while since we've had genuine hot food in our diet.
Shannon said.
I'm probably gonna be stocked up for weeks now.
Knight said, swallowing the last of his sandwich. Shannon rolled her eyes.
You'll have to excuse my friend. He appears to have forgotten all his manners over the last couple of years.
Which is exactly why I wanted to speak with you. Hale said, you two are the only two adults that weren't captured or killed when the Altari overran Terra Nova. Why?
Shannon shrugged.
Luck?
Hale bit back his frustration, knowing it wouldn't get him anywhere with these two. He nodded to Knight.
I recognize you from the Breitenfeld.
The man smiled.
Ship's counterintelligence officer. That was a great job.
You left right around the time the Toth were defeated at Earth.
Captain Valdar didn't seem to care to have me on board anymore.
Ibarra was involved,
Hale said, more a statement than a question. Knight nodded.
He was the boss.
I can think of several different adjectives for that traitor,
Hale said.
His methods were unorthodox, Shannon said. That doesn't make him a traitor.
You've been out here a long time. A lot has changed back on Earth.
Shannon motioned at him with her mug.
Well, you're here now. I'm guessing that means we beat the Zaros. Took back the galaxy and saved humanity, eh? That was pretty much Ibarra's life mission.
We won, Hale said, but it cost us much.
War is never pretty,
Shannon said, sipping her coffee.
No, it isn't.
Looks like we've got some catching up to do.
Shannon said.
You'll have plenty of time for that later,
Hale said.
Now I want you to tell me everything you know about what happened here. Where'd the Triumvirate come from? Why did they kidnap all the colonists? Why is my brother helping them?
Shannon sniffed, setting her mug on the table. She considered it for a moment, then said,
I told Morton to leave it alone. I knew it would only lead to trouble, but the old bastard couldn't let sleeping dogs lie.
What do you mean?
Shannon leaned back in her chair, crossing her arms.
About 5 years after we arrived here, some of our satellites picked up some strange signals coming from one of the outer system planets.
Negev,
Hale offered.
Right. It was weak, and it was alien. We got the preliminary scans back, and I could tell right away it was off.
What do you mean?
Shannon shrugged.
It just did. I've seen plenty of prisons in my lifetime, and that damned mountain was built so that its occupants wouldn't be able to escape, not without help. What alien race carves screaming faces into a mountain as a welcome mat? But Morton didn't hesitate. Setting the trapped, helpless aliens free was his mantra for months. I told the Council several times to leave it alone, but they wouldn't listen. That I joined the mission as an education specialist and not as an agent made it hard to sell my area of expertise. They cut me out of the mission. Didn't think my negativity was good for the rest of the people working on the project. For as much good as it did.
Hale raised an eyebrow, and Shannon shrugged again.
Old habits die hard, I guess. I hacked the colony's secure system and watched the mission's progress from my classroom. The colony's IT guys weren't that great at their job. Either that, or they were just naive.
They were amateurs,
Knight said.
Thought just because we were alone out here, there wasn't a threat to their systems. Thank God for the dumb ones, as we used to say in the trade.
Yeah, Shannon said. They were hacks. Anyway, when I saw what they'd released from that mountain, I couldn't just turn a lifetime of behind-the-scenes work off and play school teacher while they set us all up for disaster.
You mean spying for Ibarra and assassinating innocent people? Hale said, not bothering to keep the disgust out of his voice.
Innocent is a relative term, Mr. Hale, Shannon said. Innocence really depends on who's pulling the trigger, doesn't it?
You're a murderer, Shannon. Plain and simple. I learned about all the work you did for Ibarra after you... Not wasn't you, precisely. I know what you are, a procedural, a human being grown in a tube and implanted with memories. Ibarra copied you several times, something you never did for anyone else, oddly enough. You may not be guilty of those crimes, but you've got all those memories of what you did for Ibarra. Part of me wants you to own up to those crimes, especially after what you did to... No, wasn't you.
Not much of a trial if you've already determined I'm guilty, Shannon said. She cocked her head to the side. Incidentally, why wouldn't you be able to have it your way? Aren't you the one in charge of this whole damn planet now? I think you could do whatever you want.
Because I'm the governor, not a dictator. And right now, I need information about what we're dealing with out here. And right now, you're the only person in this new galaxy that can shed any kind of light on the situation.
That's gotta eat at your pride a little bit, eh?
Knight said, picking up another half of a sandwich and taking an oversized bite. Hale caught himself.
These two have made their lives deceiving and lying and conning people, Hale thought. He needed to stay on track. Going down the path they were leading him would get them nowhere fast. Hale took a deep breath. What happened with the Triumvirate?
Shannon considered him for a moment, then sniffed and sat up.
They're bastards. I watched as Morton and his team opened the mountain and released the Altari. It took a few days, but the linguists finally managed to work up an accurate translation device. That's when the Triumvirate gave us their sob story about persecution and hundreds of years of exile and imprisonment, and that they were eternally grateful for our help. Kyrios played his role perfectly. I'll give him that.
Kyrios?
The Emperor,
Knight said. Shannon nodded.
Kyrios, Seaguide, and Zvira. Emperor, Archduke, and Prince. It's what they call themselves.
According to them, they were locked away by something they called the Sacred Intelligence, which had some kind of partnership with the Triumvirate before things went south, imprisoned for violating some unknown rule set down by the SI. They were vague on that part,
which was the first of many red flags to me. I mean, if you've been locked away by an artificial intelligence for hundreds of years, you're gonna know exactly why you've been put away, right?
Shannon waved her hands through the air, rolling her eyes.
Oh, of course, everyone's innocent, right? Everyone deserves a second chance.
Well, you see what that got us.
So, Hale said, a wolf